to Twill, the Week in Health Law, the Snowmageddon podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on January the 14th, 2016. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
This week on Twill, we're pleased to introduce Gian McKee, an associate professor at the Miller Center of Public Affairs and associate professor of public policy at the University of Virginia. McKee is a historian on social and urban policy, the author of, quote, The Problem of Jobs, Liberalism, Race, and Deindustrialization in Philadelphia, that was published in 2008 by University of Chicago Press. He's currently working on a new project that will examine the rise of the healthcare economy in American cities after World War II, focusing on the development of hospitals and academic medical centers as critical but problematic urban economic anchors. Big welcome, Gian.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on today.
First, just to pick up on a couple of things that are lying around my desk and Frank's, a quick lightning round. And Frank, you've been following some new activity from the FTC.
Absolutely, Nick. There was a lot of excitement this week with the new big data report in which the FTC tries to strike a balance. They've got a title, you know, is big data either a tool for inclusion or exclusion? And it's a very balanced report where they look at many dynamics in the big data pricing, in big data used to tailor services, to personalize, et cetera, looking at both the positive side of, say, tailored healthcare and the negative side of, say, people being denied opportunities, denied credit, denied housing, denied other things, potentially on the basis of big data that includes things like healthcare information. And I thought that the report did a great job, especially on page 10, and we'll link to this on our show notes page, talking about problems like creating or reinforcing disparities, exposing sensitive information, targeting vulnerable consumers for fraud, and creating new justifications for exclusion. I was a little disappointed, though, in that, you know, it is a report, but it doesn't quite get to the level of guidelines or, say, hard and fast rules. And I know that in the tech policy space, there's this dilemma for agencies, which is that when they offer guidances, they're seen as being too ambiguous. And when they offer rules, they're seen as being not allowing tech to sort of develop in its full flowering. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more guidance out of the report.
We've both traversed this landscape a few times, Frank. Over the last 4 years, there have been a large handful of White House and FTC reports and or proposals looking at the big data issue. While this new report keeps that ball rolling, I think it also shows the FTC at its sort of pragmatic best. The message of this report surely is that while legislation may be unlikely, it doesn't follow that big data use exists in a legal vacuum. Much of this report, I think, is designed to remind businesses that many uses of big data not only will be covered by the FTC's Section 5 general powers, but also by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the FCRA, ADA, the Fair Housing Act, GINA, and so on. What struck me about this particular piece from the FTC was the emphasis they placed on FTC enforcement of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act's disparate impact prohibition, suggesting to me at least that the agency may be taking a hard look at some business practices within that frame. Recall how over a relatively short time the FTC has developed, admittedly using its Section 5 powers, quite an interesting jurisprudence with regard to privacy and security law. And I wonder if this is a hint that additional scrutiny is going to come from the enforcement part of the agency. I don't know whether you buy into that, Frank.
That's a terrific point, Nick. And, you know, and I should have acknowledged in my opening that, you know, there is a lot of pressure on the agency from Congress. I think we may have discussed earlier this year the hearings on the unfairness authority and, you know, various Congress members questioning and potentially, you know, taking a very hard look at FTC alleged expansions of jurisdiction. And so you're absolutely right to say that this is something of a shot across the bow in talking up the applicability of those laws. Also, just a shout out to one of our past show guests, Ifeoma Ajunwa, who was on the show talking about disparate impact back in the summer. I do think that this is, you could see this report as essentially really solidifying what was a rapidly emerging consensus that big data use is going to need a lot more legal scrutiny and compliance attention in the coming years.
Yeah, it's completely agreed. So let's move on to some interlocking news stories about health insurance and Medicaid, and look at some folks who are either keeping their New Year's resolutions or even this early in the new year have abandoned them. First, of course, we turn to Kentucky. It's now pretty clear that Governor Bevin is closing Connect, the state-run exchange, and is therefore moving the precious metal policy sales to the federal exchange. It's way too early to say whether this will adversely affect the 80,000 or so residents who so far have bought their policies on the state exchange. Theoretically, it shouldn't. But by all accounts, and therefore with a large dose of irony, Connect is apparently very easy to use and provides very good information. A footnote to problems with healthcare.gov. What does seem clear, at least to an outsider, is that it doesn't seem to make much sense financially. The feds gave Kentucky $290 million to build the Connect exchange. And channeling one of my favorite West Wing episodes, wouldn't it be fun if the feds asked for the money back? Secondly, it's going to cost Kentucky about $20 million to dismantle Connect. And that seems an awful lot of money to spend in a really, really poor state. And third, there are financial implications looking forward. I believe Connect was sort of revenue neutral, whereas the federal exchange will levy a 3.5% assessment on sales. So it's unclear how that might play out in the marketplace. There's better news for the 400,000 or so Kentucky residents who benefited from Medicaid expansion. The governor has backed down from his election promise to roll that back, and now he seems to be seeking a waiver from CMS to modify the program. As Nikki Huberfeld said on the show a few episodes ago, the governor is likely to be looking for something like the Indiana HIP 2.0 plan. But what's interesting, of course, is would CMS really have much interest in approving such a plan when full expansion is already in place in Kentucky? If you're pro-ACA, there's bad news in Virginia, where Governor McAuliffe's deal with the hospitals to fund Medicaid expansion was rejected by leaders of the General Assembly. But far better news in Louisiana, where on his second day in office, Governor John Bel Edwards signed an executive order expanding Medicaid coverage and potentially covering 300,000 Louisiana residents. Meanwhile, and I'm not sure whether this is just good policy or whether, in fact, it's good politics, President Obama's budget proposal would extend the 3-year initial funding for any new states to expand Medicaid, a plan that still probably has the greatest potential to bring insurance to the 4 million or so citizens who had Medicaid expansion jeopardized by the Supreme Court decision in Sebelius.
That is a great rundown, Nick. And I guess for our final story in the lightning round, I just wanted to point up to listeners an interesting note from Darius Tahir called Meaningful Use, a Partisan Issue? ? And it is a piece in Political Morning eHealth where they note that essentially the Republican staff seems to be more critical of meaningful use than the Democratic staff, and that this seems to be a divide that's widening over time. And it'll be very interesting to see to what extent does meaningful use become a political football over time and something that might be subject to or just chalked up to being one of the number of government programs that the Republican side would like to see cut down in favor of a more vigorous private sector role.
Yes, and as we said, I think it was last week, the potential for death by 1,000 paper cuts. So as we bring Ian into the conversation, In thinking about his work, I started thinking down very sort of traditional lines. I was thinking about the Commonwealth Fund's To America's report of 3 years ago or so on. Some of Margot Sanger Katz's reporting in The Times, leading me into sort of an overgeneralization about our health disparities as being something of roughly a sort of North-South issue. But thinking more about where you seem to be going, Ian, your work seems far more highly focused. You look at individual cities, I think even neighborhoods, not only from the perspective of health and other disparities, but also on the potential role of healthcare as sort of as an economic engine. And as you join the conversation, I wondered if you could expand on this for us.
Well, thank you again for having me on today. And that's a good summary, I think, of where I'm coming from with this work. My background is really as an urban historian, and I wrote a book about deindustrialization in Philadelphia after World War II, looking at local strategies interacting with federal policies that tried to deal with that problem, mostly in the 60s and 70s. And the end point of that story was that I looked around Philadelphia in the early 21st century, and if you look at places like West Philadelphia around the University of Pennsylvania, or North Philadelphia, where you have Temple, you have these massive healthcare complexes. And this is, of course, as we are moving into the period of debate over healthcare reform in the United States. And I kind of made the connection that there's something significant here, that we have healthcare as an economic sector that accounts for almost 18% of gross domestic product, and it has this concentration in cities like Philadelphia or Baltimore that have gone through this traumatic process of losing their manufacturing base. And I was really interested by that relationship between healthcare as a provider of services, healthcare as a source, according to conventional wisdom, of one of the key pressures on government budgets, and yet its role in the economic survival of many cities, and not just big cities, but communities around the United States. And that really led me to this process of looking into its history, how we've developed those relationships.
That is a great precis, Ian, and I really appreciate your look at this issue. And it's something that's often comes to mind as, you know, someone I've worked in Newark, now I'm in Baltimore, and I think we see very similar dynamics all along the Amtrak line from Boston to Washington. And I'm one of the things, just to get us into your Post article, which I think was so interesting about the relationship, say, between Baltimore's political economy and potential healthcare cost cuts. I wanted to just lay a little bit of a foundation in terms of the discussion in urban development about meds and eds. There was a lot of people who I think over the past couple of decades have argued that the salvation of a lot of urban cores post-industrialization would be the development of both education and medical centers that would bring in top talent and that would serve the community, try to address some of the underlying health disparities and other issues. But then we've always had this countervailing narrative, I think from the Peterson Institute, from other advocates of austerity, saying that the medical sector is this sort of vampiric force sucking energy out of the economy, that things would be great in America if only we weren't spending 17% of GDP on healthcare. We could be, you know, as dynamic an economy as, say, France, where they spend 9%. And I'm wondering, you know, in thinking about this tension, how do you think that tension is reflected in a city like Baltimore?
You may be the first scholar in a long time to cite France as a dynamic economy, but I take your point absolutely here. Yeah, you know, I think Baltimore is a really great case of that, because it's a city that really lost much of its industrial base, much of what had sustained the city, and obviously went through a process of dramatic turnover in terms of its population as well. And yet it's also the home of one of the, you know, really premier medical centers, arguably the original modern academic medical center in Johns Hopkins, and a number of other hospitals and medical centers that have grown up. And those are now the leading employers in the city by a long, long way. And there are all kinds of interesting dimensions of that. On the one hand, without the jobs that Hopkins and other hospitals provide, the city would be in far, far worse shape. But there are also questions that activists in Baltimore have raised about the conditions of employment, about the wages that are paid, the benefit levels. There is a strike in, I believe, 2014, a series of strikes by the Hospital Workers Union, part of the SEIU, where they made as one of their main arguments that Hopkins workers were often on food stamps. And so there's a question as to what kind of jobs are actually being provided. And that gets you into the question and the dynamics that you mentioned of healthcare spending. And what do we expect of an institution like Hopkins or the healthcare system in general when we look at it as more than just a provider of healthcare services or medical research, but as this major social institution that's responsible for things like community-based economic development? Is that something that's viable? Is that a role that they should be playing? Can they do it at all? And if so, how do they do it well? And it ties very much into that larger question of how we understand the role of healthcare spending, I think, and what can be sustained, what can't be, how we should shape the priorities for thinking about the system's future.
I completely agree with that. And I'm going to raise two points, and feel free to take either or both in a direction afterward. One is, I think that the big problem that particularly you highlight in raising the plight of, say, the janitors, home health aides, others, is that we've been having a national conversation about cutting healthcare in general. And that national conversation has occluded the fact that, you know, within the healthcare sectors, there are some folks that have done spectacularly well. I mean, I think particularly the private equity chains that, say, do for-profit nursing homes or buy hospital chains or the things like that. And then you could have some people that are doing very poorly. I think of the home health aides in particular who are have been excluded from any labor protections and, you know, have been protesting working conditions in various venues. And I think that really what we need to be having is a conversation about reallocation of healthcare dollars, or possibly, as Bill Baumol has suggested in his work on the cost disease, simply increasing the share of the economy that goes to healthcare. This is not a radical fringe position. It's something that, you know, Princeton economist Baumol has said would actually be a hallmark of a civilized society. A second point that I would make, and before I forget, I should say my note on France's dynamism was really a bit of a tweak, or meant as a bit of a detournement of the Peterson Institute. It was not necessarily my objective assessment, but sorry about that. My humor can sometimes be a little dry on the show.
Oh, I totally understood. I took it as such. I noted the humor there.
But the other direction that I wanted to go in is something that I am increasingly reading as healthcare's messiah complex, which is that you have a lot of healthcare institutions that are being called upon. Apparently now the shift might be to say, well, you've been taking a lot of money for the care side, but now we want you to essentially solve community level problems. We want you to solve population health and address the social determinants of health. And I'm wondering if you think either of those points are of interest in future research here, either that we should be having this conversation about reallocating healthcare expenditures, or if the healthcare system perhaps could redeem itself by shifting from allocating money to care itself on the back end to addressing the social determinants of health on the front end?
Yeah, great questions. Let me take the first point about cost. And I think I'll go right to Baumol's argument about the cost disease, which is, I think, a fascinating position because it's so counterintuitive to the standard narrative, which says, you know, as you indicated, that we have to cut. We have to find ways to restrain spending on healthcare. And I find it to be a position that would solve a lot of problems in my own work, in a sense, if we could go there and say, you know, that we're going to you know, take this spending as a form of development and accept it as such, whether it's economic development, community development, or the determinants of healthcare side. The fascinating question for me is the premises that, at least as I understand it, the cost disease position operates on, which is essentially that healthcare, along with sectors like education and I guess the arts, are essentially stagnant sectors that are where it's very difficult to derive productivity increases. increases, so the costs, particularly the relative costs, will always go up compared to other sectors that are constantly having productivity rises. And also because of those productivity increases in other sectors, we can actually afford healthcare. And as I said, if that's the case, and if we can build policy structures that account for that, it solves a lot of our dilemmas around this, that maybe we can say, all right, Johns Hopkins, you know, go ahead and run your institution as a jobs policy. The question I'd raise about that, and I guess I'm falling or stepping back into the more conventional picture, is that point about the policy structures and whether our political system is actually ever going to be able to make the choices that would allow that kind of vision to be accomplished. And I think we're still in a point where it'd be at least very uncertain that it ever could, that it could accept that premise, make the other kinds of investment. And that gets us into the binds that we face, where we see healthcare as crowding out other forms of social investment, whether it's education, whether it's, you know, infrastructure, all kinds of other policy ends that we'd like to pursue. So can you actually get to the point where Baumol's vision could be realized politically in a way that is viable in terms of short or even medium-term budget considerations? There's also the point that I think economists like Catherine Becker at Harvard raise that, and I don't think she's directly addressing Baumol, but simply that we should be thinking about efficiency in all cases. And are there ways simply to make healthcare more efficient? And could you derive some of the same benefits, both in terms of healthcare provision, but also maintaining some of the employment in a long-term sustainable fashion if you find efficiencies in healthcare? So these are things I'm still wrestling with. I'm not entirely prepared to come down one way or the other on those kinds of issues, but I think that's the dynamic around Baumol's idea and the cost disease principle and our larger debate over cost control. Turning to your second point on the Messiah complex, which I like that phrase in terms of thinking about healthcare and the idea that these institutions can solve wider problems. I think that's exactly what's going on. And that was part of what I wrote about in my piece in the Washington Post of what's happening in Maryland right now. We're in the aftermath of the unrest in Baltimore last year after the death of Freddie Gray. The city's healthcare institutions, led by Hopkins, University of Maryland, Mercy Health, I believe, came together and made a request to the Maryland Health Services Cost Review Commission, which is really at this point the only state healthcare rate regulator left in the U.S., to increase hospital rates in order to add 1,000 jobs in healthcare around the city. And the HSCRC initially denied the request. Since I wrote the article, they've formulated a compromise position where they're going to create about 375 jobs funded by a combination of a rate increase and redirection of hospital budgets. That's kind of an addendum to that story. This is actually the culmination of debates, both public and internal to Hopkins, that have gone on since the early 1960s, actually, about whether Hopkins should be taking on this kind of wider social role beyond its more narrow traditional mission of teaching, research, and healthcare service provision. And there are a couple of things that are really fascinating about that. You know, for one question has always been, what can Hopkins itself actually sustain? What are the resources of this institution, wealthy as it is? That's a much easier argument to answer right now, where Hopkins is doing extremely well, I think, by any realistic assessment of their budget. In the 60s and 70s, it was actually less true. They were, in many respects, struggling financially for a number of years. But nonetheless, there is that question of what is the mission of this institution? What can it sustain? But I think the even more interesting dimension of this is, in many respects, these nominally private, nominally not-for-profit institutions are the last institution standing in places like Baltimore. And they have capacities, regardless of where the limits lie, that far exceed those of city governments. And as a society, we really haven't, I think, asked what are the implications of asking an entity like Hopkins to take on a larger role in the development of communities, in the management of these big questions that, you know, in theory would be a public concern. It's actually an old pattern in terms of American state development of these kind of associational models where the public and private interact to the point that the public-private boundary blurs at times to being almost impossible to identify. And I think in general, that's sort of where we're going in terms of the role of the healthcare sector in big cities at this point, that, you know, urban governments at the moment simply don't have the capacity, given what we're willing to spend on urban investment right now to do this. And we have places like Hopkins that are located in the inner city and to some extent have their own fate intertwined with what's going on in their very immediate neighborhoods. And it seems like a natural leap to say, okay, Hopkins can do this. But I don't think we've always thought through exactly what the implications are.
I'm glad you brought up the crowding out point in your first point answering Frank. But perhaps something that was missing from that is that these healthcare cost or healthcare cost growth also crowds out wages, which must have an impact on the kind of issues you raise. I don't know what the magic number is with regard to the percentage of GDP, but it looks like we're going to be going above the 17, close to 18%. And at some point, presumably, one has to say there is a point where you can't go much further. I was delighted that you brought up Catherine Becker's work. Yesterday, actually, in my healthcare quality and safety course, I quoted the Becker and Chandra article, in an efficient system, more spending on healthcare would be a sign of prosperity and a harbinger of improved health and longevity, not a cause for concern. But, of course, their point, as you noted, was that our healthcare resources are not being spent efficiently and may not even be the primary driver of improved outcomes. So that's a great piece that we'll put in the show notes. I also have to sort of move you into the cost price issue, thinking of things like Steve Brill's piece in Time and more recently his book on healthcare generally and the Affordable Care Act, and our friend of the show, Aaron Fuse Brown's work on pricing. Surely there is at least part of this puzzle has to be controlling cost by going not only after volume, which is basically how we've been looking at cost, but also going after price. And it needn't necessarily be the kind of healthcare that you are advocating, but should look at controlling drug prices and also controlling markups generally, as sort of there are the number of rent seekers throughout our healthcare economy seem to play. I wonder whether any of those points resonate with you and are comfortable fellows with what you're talking about, or you find them oppositional.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point in terms of the actual details of the way all this intersects. One of the interesting things about Maryland and Baltimore and the role of the HSCRC is that they've had an all-payer system in place since the 70s. And I guess the answer that case would lead you to is that you need both, that you need a way to think about volume control, but that it can be really helpful to get into the prices as well. You know, a free market advocate would say, well, no, we should just let the markets set the prices and all will be well. I mean, if there's an industry that's farther from free market perfect competition than healthcare, I'm not sure what it would be. The separation of purchasers from providers, all of the intermediaries involved, make any kind of, I think, market forces arguments close to irrelevant in this sector. What you've seen in Maryland is that they've done well in terms of controlling the prices of services. But the volume issue in terms of the larger incentives of fee-for-service medicine have still driven the overall rate of cost increase in the state to the point that it's only been a partial solution. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services 2 years ago issued an additional waiver for Maryland to set overall caps on hospital spending. And those will interact with the HSCRC's regulation of the rates being charged. And I think this is actually one of the more interesting experiments going on right now. It hasn't received a huge amount of attention, at least in the popular press, more so among scholars and policy experts. But the point being there that it really blends the two approaches, I think, in ways that are interesting. But yeah, it's both the larger incentives of controlling the urge to always do more, but also going back to some of the models that we looked at and discarded in the 20th century, such as rate regulation and the specific costs and charges that are being and prices that are being negotiated in the system.
So I think we're getting close to our time. So I just wanted to raise one. Perhaps it's a left field question, but I think it's something that is on a lot of people's minds. And I think it relates to the worldview of, say, the economists and the worldview of urban policy experts and lawyers and how they all might fit together. And it relates to essentially the idea that Becker was discussing of efficiency and always pushing towards more efficiency and trying to square this circle that you've repeatedly mentioned, Guillen. And what I'm wondering is, we see a lot of scenarios in healthcare where, for example, let's say in terms of consent for data use, there are complaints that the consent procedures are incredibly complex. And then we see lots of situations where, say, there are introduction of either clinical decision support aids or of other forms of automation in healthcare. And then they lead to unexpected consequences, or there isn't quite the penetration that we want, or there are other problems that arise out of the introduction of these things. I also recently saw a study that said that out of people who get apps from their hospital for follow-up care, only 2% use the app. You know, so there again, where people like Clay Christensen are saying, oh, this is going to be the disruptive future of medicine, it's constantly falling short. And what I'm wondering is perhaps a way that we can square this circle is, do we think that the future of automation in medicine and technological advance, that this advance, rather than substituting for people, will only happen if we bring more people in to ensure its proper use? Do you think that's a possible answer here? Because clearly we've been hearing from lots of people in Silicon Valley that the robots are here to take all the jobs, including those of doctors, lawyers, professors, educators, MOOCs will do everything, et cetera. Do you think, in fact, maybe the counter-narrative here is something along the lines that what we're seeing in healthcare and what we'll see elsewhere is that the proper advance of efficiency is more one of man-machine cooperation than one of machines substituting for humans?
Yeah, I completely agree with that, actually. I think a good comparison is the whole idea of MOOCs, massive open online courses in higher education. And if you recall, a few years ago, that was going to solve all of the problems in higher education and make it, you know, affordable and accessible for people everywhere. And those models have, I think, increasingly seem to be limited because you very much need at least to have really top quality college education. You need the input of the talented expert in the room. And it's not that technology has no role to play, but the idea that you're simply going to eliminate the professor or the instructor and the human interaction has really proven, I think, to be a false premise. And I think healthcare is a good analog to that, that to make the technology work, we're going to need the intersections of the nurse, the physician's assistant, maybe the health advocate out in the community. I don't think I addressed that very well earlier, that this idea of wraparound services and the role of institutions in providing those is going to be key to getting a patient to use that app and to use it in the right way, maybe even to know the app exists. And so, I don't think we're ever going to take the human element out of healthcare completely. But we do need to be thinking how we can most intelligently use human skills, develop human capabilities in interaction with the technology. So I think I'm if I'm getting to the point of your question, I really do see that as the promise here. And maybe you know, there's even an opening there in terms of the role of these institutions as social institutions, as well as medical institutions, and that there can be some kind of associational balance found that they continue to play a role in promoting development of the communities and maybe doing an even better job than they have, because I haven't gotten into all of the difficulties that it's posed, but there have been a lot of problems with this model as well in terms of what it's meant for communities to have these big institutions in their backyard.
And carefully skirting around the dystopian projection that a future co-host of TWiL will be a robot, that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Professor McKee for joining us today. Great fun having you with us, Ian.
It's been wonderful. Thanks again for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We post our show notes at twill.com. If you have a moment, please go to iTunes and rate the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be reached this week?
I can be reached at HealthPI on Twitter as well.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.